Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a show published weekly or so featuring technology guests and opinions from the data networking industry. On Packet Pushers, people like me who build networks for a living gather in the virtual conference room like this one right now to talk about what we do. I am Ethan Banks, network engineer, CCIE, and blogger at packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks, where I tweet nerdy, and add me to your circles on Google+, where I post links to interesting articles as well as info related to this show. You can also find me on LinkedIn and on many other fine social networking sites. Facebook not really being one of them at this point. If you're looking for me on Facebook, I've totally given up all hope that Facebook will ever be anything other than an evil plaguing the internet, and I'm just done with it, other than a very few people that I still have as friends. I'm really done with Facebook. So, okay. Now, this show today is one of these nerdy deep dive kind of shows, and I want to set some background for what this show is going to be about, and then introduce the people that are going to be on the show. This came up as a topic for me at Networking Field Day 3 when we were out at San Jose. One of the things that comes up an awful lot now as you look at modern data center design are overlays, different tunneling techniques and encapsulation techniques that are involved to do things like layer 2 extension between data centers, etc. Well, the traditional way that you would do multi-tenancy separation and so on for many, many years has been MPLS. And as I began to write this post relating to an overview of tunneling and talking at a high level about all the different tunnels that are out there, the question came into my mind, is MPLS, multi-protocol label switching, is MPLS tunneling or not? Because you can argue the way it behaves, it is tunneling, and you can argue because it's really tagging, it's not tunneling. And so I got into a conversation with Ivan Pepelniak and Derek Winkworth at Netfield A3 about this, and they both had some views and so on, and then we got distracted and pulled into a different direction, and we couldn't really talk about it any further. And so, unfortunately, Derek couldn't make it today because duty called, and he just wasn't able to make the scheduled time. But we did gather Greg, of course, Greg Farrow, Petr Lapukov, Ivan Pepelniak, and Marco. Oh, man, Marco, your last name still escapes
me. Marko Milivojevic.
Yes, that one.
Yes! Yeah. Yeah.
So, Greg, let's start with you and just tell everybody how your week's going and so on, and then we'll introduce the other guys, give everybody a chance to tell everybody who they are, and then we'll get into the discussion about MPLS and whether or not it's tunneling.
Yeah, so I've had a difficult week this week, Ethan. I've had a very complicated week at work, and my spare time was just sucked up with a bunch of other things, somewhat related to I was asked as a favor to do some judging for Network World for their interop, where I've been looking at the networking products in a certain category and helping to judge. I've been learning some new things there, which has been quite a bit of fun. Otherwise, I had the evenings off. I actually had 3 evenings off this week and read some books and relaxed a little bit higher. And at the end of this weekend, after having published a podcast, edited down the while we were at Tech Field Day 3, we recorded the video session.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just finished editing that down, so that'll publish soon, I hope.
Probably by the time this show goes out, that video will have already hit. Yeah, we had a lot of fun recording that. Now, mm-hmm. You said something a minute ago. You've been asked to be a judge for interop. So I have to ask you one very important question about that, which is, what sort of bribes have come in?
Sadly, not enough.
Of course, Greg would be completely above reproach in all cases related to judging. I'm just being funny.
That's the weird thing. It was at the very time that I was actually doing it, I was asked to do some commercial work for a company, and I had to turn them down. So,
conflict of interest rears its ugly head.
Yes. That's right, and because I always have to take the one that I committed to first, so I had to say to them that I wasn't available for that until this process was completed and that I could not take any discussions on that topic. And it was just, completely unrelated, and it was, come out of from a completely different, they didn't even know at the time, so
yeah,
there's no conflict of interest there. They contacted me before it was public knowledge, so.
Well, that's a pretty cool gig, being a judge for interrupt, so at some point we'll have to catch up on what you thought of that whole process when it's all passed, and I think that'd be some fun to talk about. So Ivan Pepelniak is also with us. And Ivan, how you said it's been raining quite a bit in Slovenia?
Oh, it's been raining for the last month. And the last week was a PowerPoint week on top of that. Ooh. So I had four presentations in 3 days, and three out of four were literally in front of hundreds of people.
This was at the RIPE conference, yeah?
Yeah, I had two at RIPE conference, and they're already online. And then I had a webinar for Juniper, and they told me that a lot of people were listening to me. Mm. So I hope I didn't make any blunders.
So what did you cover at the RIPE conference? Just at a high level, I'm kind of curious what you were talking about.
The first one was more or less what we'll be talking about today. So cloud networking in the data center and all the different technologies from VLANs to what Nicira is doing with their particular overlays. And the second one was just to remind people that there's this very old thing called Cloud Fabrics, which can be used to build pretty decent data center networks.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's deep
just
stuff.
Just like we always have.
Yeah. And people have forgotten what voice people have discovered 50 years ago, and now they're reinventing the wheel.
I've got a half-written book on switching fabrics, which is all about CLOS and hypercubes and n-cube fabrics. One day I hope to finish it off and get it out.
The term hypercube is one of those that has come up a lot recently, just as I've been reading about different data center topologies that I was not familiar with, and I had to go read up on what that was just to get the vibe for it. It's like, oh, okay. Basically, you know, the mathematical construct, the tesseract, you know, the most straightforward example of a hypercube. It was interesting. A different way to think about it, although it created some cabling puzzles in my mind as to how you'd practically implement such a thing in the data center. Well, also with us is Petr Lepukov. And Petr, you work for Microsoft, is that right?
Yes, Ethan. And thanks for pronouncing my name right. So people normally call me Peter. It's slightly more familiar to the ES speaking people. And yes, I work for Microsoft, specifically for Microsoft Bing, which is a search engine, which is kind of competing with Google and Yahoo. Well, not so much with Yahoo anymore. And so my last week was mostly packed with interviews and troubleshooting. So we're constantly looking for new people, and we're constantly facing some issues. And every week goes really fast here, I can tell you for sure. And unlike Slovenia, we had pretty sunny days here recently in Redmond, which might be surprising actually, because Seattle is believed to be a pole for rain, a rain pole in the US. But amazingly, it's been pretty sunny recently here. So.
Oh, so you send it all over here. Thank you.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Don't mention this.
Well, Petr, thank you very much for joining us. Glad to have you along. And as we go through the show, Petr actually built much of the outline for the show, what we're going to talk about. How close we stick to the outline, it remains to be seen. But he's the one that recommended the direction that we follow for the show. So Marco is also with us, who's been on the show before and was at Netfield Day 3. And Marco joined us at the last minute when Derek was unable to join us to add another voice to the very opinionated folks that are already on the show. Marco, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me on such a short notice. It's always nice to be back at Packet Pushers, and I'm a little bit unprepared for what you're going to talk about today.
I went unprepared.
I went through the outline. I disagree with most of what is said there, so I think we are in for entertaining read. And,
disagree?
I'm just kidding. It's we always agree on everything, right? Especially on this show. And my last week was spent like many of my weeks are. I spent time teaching CCI students, getting them ready to pass their CCI labs. But last week, I have to admit, was a very, very special one for me. And that's for a reason that I had CCIE number 1025. Yes, the very first CCIE ever to be a CCIE. He decided he wants to regain his digits, and he came to our class. And it was very, very proud moment, and I can say that Mr. Stuart Biggs is a fantastic person.
Stuart Biggs, the first CCIE, as opposed to a lot of people think of Terry Slattery, who actually we had on the show once upon a time. Terry was the first non-Cisco employee, I believe, right?
There is the matter of a debate who is actually a first CCIE, and that's really interesting to get Stuart's view on that, and that is that Terry Slattery was the first person to actually pass the lab, so there is no disputing that. But he passed the lab that Stuart Biggs built.
Ah. I see, I see. Well, all right. So let's roll on this thing here. And again, just to refresh everybody's memory, is MPLS tunneling? MPLS being what I would perceive of, just to give you my background in MPLS, my background in MPLS is real simple. I know what I had to know to pass a few exams. I've never actually implemented MPLS in real life. So for me, MPLS is largely theoretical. I've read about it in a few chapters in books. I know most of the basic terminology. I understand some rudiments about how MPLS makes forwarding decisions, and that's about it. So I'm looking at it mostly as an outsider, someone who works with IP every day, but not MPLS specifically. And so I'm asking the guys who do know a lot about MPLS. Ivan, in case you didn't know, has written two books on the topic for Cisco Press. And to get some opinion on this, is MPLS tunneling or not? So, Petter starts out with an outline here Petter, why don't you just start off here? We've got some foundational information to talk about, circuits versus connectionless. Why don't you dive in and get the conversation rolling?
Yeah, of course. So before we actually start discussing MPLS and tunnels, I just wanted to get a quick refresh on the very fundamentals of networking and recall the things we normally skip in this networking books, the introductions talking about circuits and connections and connectionless networks, because this has some deep relation to MPLS behavior. So as all remembers, circuits normally believed to belong to traditional TDM networks, which use time-based multiplexing and which store some sort of static state in every device to tell exactly which time slot maps where and which goes to which direction. So this supposedly how networks still operate right now, some networks, specifically SoNet and SDH networks. But we are more used to work with the packet networks, IP networks, which are connectionless because we don't store any specific state for a data transfer in the network core. So basically, if you look in the routing device in the core network, you won't see specific state basically for every connection from each node on the edge to another node on the edge. So basically, it's just two different poles, connectionless packet networks and circuit-based networks, which have very precise, very exact state in every node. Connections belong somewhere in between. And a good example of connection is an ATM circuit, basically, which uses packets to transfer data, but which still stores some information in every element in the network to switch packets hop by hop. And the reason I brought this here at first is that MPLS LSP is specifically an example of connection-oriented transport, because MPLS transport stores network state in every element, but at the same time, it performs packet switching. So it's just a very, very brief version of fundamentals. And I believe we've been discussing with Ivan once, I guess, maybe 2 years ago on his blog, when talking about differences between MPLS and IP. And I'm not sure if Ivan agrees with my point of view here.
I totally agree.
Okay, excellent.
MPLS is like frame relay with a different signaling plane, and that's it.
Yeah, so
I actually think that MPLS would be much closer to what ATM did rather than frame relay.
Or ATM, okay.
They're all similar, but just ATM was more fancy and much more ambitious in it claims. So the first actually question I would like to ask Ivan personally is, how would you define the concept of tunnel? So what is a tunnel per se, basically?
Well, the way I look at the difference between virtual circuits, and we just agreed that virtual circuits means frame relay or ATM or MPLS, is with virtual circuits, the core, as you said, has to keep the state of the connections between the end nodes. Whereas with tunnels, and let's say GRE is in tunnel, just to know what we're talking about.
Okay.
With tunnels, there is absolutely no state in the core. you could have hundreds of routers in one subnet and hundreds of routers in the other subnet, and they would all have geo-read tunnels between themselves, and all the core routers would have would be two subnets in their IP routing table. On the other main difference that I see is that with virtual circuits, two traffic flows that once merge can then diverge and go over different paths and merge again and diverge again and so on. So every single end node to end node connection has its own path. Whereas with tunnels, the only thing the core switches or routers do is they look at the destination IP address in case of GRE tunnel and send the traffic to that destination. So with virtual circuits, we can influence where the traffic flows. With tunnels, we can't.
I would like to inject here something that what you are saying, of course, makes sense, but it also, to me, it doesn't make sense at the same time, because I think it's just a difference of what we consider to be the state in the core. And I think this is something that we may need to further clarify and define, because you could theoretically claim that the routing tables on the core routers are also kind of a state.
So yes, you can aggregate that.
So it's just where do we move the line of what we consider to be an additional state or not? And the further thing that you can influence where the traffic goes as far as the tunnel is concerned, and not and you can do it for the virtual circuits, when it comes to MPLS versus, for example, GRE, you can divert and move around the GRE traffic in your core using IP PBR. Routing methods like not only the PBR, but you can also use the summarization. You can use the static routes to diverge the traffic. You can do all sorts of tricks that you would otherwise do for IP traffic, but for a virtual circuit like for MPLS, the really circuit is end-to-end. It is the signaled path between the two nodes, and you have to move the whole path and not just redirect traffic at some point, which is perfectly possible with IP traffic. So your description of what you think is the tunneling or the virtual circuits, as I said, it makes sense, but again, it doesn't make sense as the differentiator between the two. The way I see the tunneling, how I would define the tunnel, is carrying information with for one protocol within another layer of that same protocol. So for me, to consider something the tunneling, it needs to contain the hierarchical information of the same kind of which the outermost shell is used to make the forwarding decisions through the core of the network, and the inner shell is considered to make the multiplexing or demultiplexing decision at the endpoint.
Okay, so yesterday I sat down and tried to formulate a most abstract definition of a tunnel, and it came with me as tunnel is a layer of forwarding indirection. So essentially, just like an API in the software stack adds some sort of indirection, tunnels also create some sort of forwarding indirection of some kind. And we can discuss how MPLS does it differently from IP, but in some sense, they both perform the same function. So let's take Marco's example of, let's say, GRE tunnel carrying IP traffic. Let's say you have multiple GRE headers in this tunnel. Does this break the tunneling property or not? Let's say you have 1, 2, 3, 4 GRE headers. And for example, the first header points to loopback 0 of first router. The second header points to the next loopback router of the next router, and so on and so forth. So essentially, you specify a source route in these headers, right? And the actual payload is hidden behind, let's say, 4 or 5 layers of indirection. This still remains a tunnel, right? But now we created 5 layers of indirection for forwarding, and we perform precisely the same function as MPLS does. We do source routing, but we just use header stacking for this purpose. However, in MPLS, you may have just one header and every hop, but since you store some additional state in every device, you may still pre-signal this source route in every device and tell the LSP how it's supposed to go in the network. So the only difference, if you look at this, is that IP addresses are essentially global labels, and MPLS labels are simply local to the device. And so from this viewpoint, MPLS tunnels and IP tunnels are very similar in this sense. Just MPLS with this local labeling.
Okay, Peter, would you also call frame relay and ATM tunnels then?
In some sense, yes, because we create a layer of indirection between the LP protocol and physical network, and they specify the forwarding directives of how to deliver traffic from one point to another.
Now, I think that right now you are sort of mixing layering, layer two, layer three, with tunneling.
Encapsulation and decapsulation. I was thinking about the exact same thing.
Following this to the end, you could call Ethernet tunneling.
Exactly.
There's no there's no difference between frame relay and Ethernet.
Well,
There is. And the important thing that we should point out here is that for frame relay and for ATM and for MPLS, for the things that we have defined as circuits, end-to-end circuits, the layering information in the encapsulating header, let's call it the MPLS label or the DLCI, DLC4 frame relay or the VPVC pair for ATM, changes whenever the switching has been done. So the part of the packet transmission of this information throughout the core of our network changes at every point. But for Ethernet, the destination MAC address remains the same. The same thing would be for the GRE tunnel. The endpoint IP address doesn't change as the packet goes through the network. So
I think the big difference, though, between MPLS frame relay and ATM is that the destination addresses of those protocols is stateful. That is, there's a path defined with those addresses before the path is traversed. That is, you can't send a packet into an ATM network before there's an endpoint. You can't send a packet into an MPLS network until the labels have propagated end-to-end through the circuit. Whereas for Ethernet and IP, your destination addresses or your addresses are statelessly discovered. That is, you can send an Ethernet frame to a destination address without knowing where the destination address, you just send it and it gets there. And for IP frames, it's different. That, to me, is the fundamental difference between a tunnel and a protocol, like a non-encapsulated, non-tunnel protocol, is that a protocol that has an address which is determined via an end-to-end signaling protocol with a specified destination address is a tunnel.
Well, by your own definition, then, Ethernet is a prime example of a tunnel, because in Ethernet, you cannot send any frame into the network unless you know the destination of it. How you learn the destination of the frame is determined by the end-to-end signaling protocol called the ARP. So,
yes.
So Ethernet is tunneling by that definition. So I think that Ivan here got to the bottom of the problem is, how do we define the tunneling? How do we call it? And I mean, what's really the tunneling? And why does it matter?
Well, there's something to be said here about Ethernet, which is that frame is only going to last on the local network. Yeah, you've done an encapsulation, but as soon as you hop a layer 3 boundary and push that Ethernet frame across that layer 3 boundary elsewhere, you've now got a different source and destination MAX potentially.
Ethan, that's also true for MPLS, frame relay, ATM, and any other layer 2 or layer 2.5 protocol.
But not for a tunnel like an IP tunnel. An IP tunnel, you've got the same source and destination IP address to get that packet with whatever its encapsulated payload is from one end of the logical tunnel to the other.
Correct. And you're absolutely right. And the same thing applies for Ethernet, for example. You will get the IP payload, which is unknown to the Ethernet switches, across the switched cloud, based end-to-end based on the destination MAC address, where the destination MAC address will be stripped from the frame and the packet will be delivered to the endpoint. The same thing, as Ivan said, is true for MPLS frame relay and ATM.
But this is like the classical layering discussion, right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
So we are mixing tunneling and layering.
But okay, I think it's a classic problem. Every time you try to mix and add tunneling to OSI model, you always get lost somehow.
Yes.
So, I guess the point I was trying to make with my Ethernet comparison is I think you can maybe put a finger on what is a tunnel by saying it's got across a layer 3 boundary. No.
Ethan, no. Trill is also tunneling.
That's true.
Q in Q tunnels, that's also tunneling, even though it happens directly on layer 2.
Okay, so show define tunneling as a shim layer, then, basically. A shim layer, let's say you repeat Ethernet twice, MAC and MAC, or you repeat IP twice, IP-IP tunneling. So you take a layer in OSI model and repeat it twice in the stack, and there you go. Okay, you got the tunnel, right?
Well, whoever said before that you need to see the same layer repeated twice in the protocol stack, and that is a tunnel, that was a good definition.
That would be me, but that breaks with the technologies like, for example, VXLAN, which is also...
It is Ethernet, IP, UDP, VXLAN, MAC, IP.
Okay. Now, Ivan thinks of IP in HTTP. So there are tunnel protocols which transport IP in HTTP, for example, some proxies.
Yeah,
is this a tunneling?
Yes.
But now you inject different layers. So HTTP layer 7 and then IP layer 3. Now it's upper layer carrying lower layer.
Who cares?
But it's not our repetition of the same layer, right?
No. Peter, we take Marco's definition.
Right.
And we say, let's draw the whole protocol stack. And if we see a single layer repeated twice in the protocol stack, we have a tunnel.
Repeated twice in the protocol stack. But it's the same as layer of indirection. You just add a layer of indirection somehow, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think what we're trying to do is come up with a tunnel definition, which is saying that if you have a MAC address and then you have MAC address in the stack again, then that's a tunnel. If you have IP and then you have IP appearing in the frame again, then that's a tunnel. And by that definition, multiple MPLS tags would be a tunnel, which of course it is.
Correct.
But the first time around, it's not tunneled. So for the first tag that's inserted on a frame, when you first push a single MPLS tag on, that's not tunneling. But when you do a second tag pop, then that's tunneling.
Absolutely right. And I think, Greg, that you have nailed down the exact source of the confusion that people usually have when they think about MPLS and think of it as tunneling. Because MPLS on its own with a single label, the single transport label, doesn't really make much sense. It doesn't actually solve any problems other than maybe scalability of the core networks.
In 1998, when tag switching from Cisco was first introduced, and I remember reading white papers and attending presentations, the purpose of tag switching, which later became MPLS, was to reduce the number of routes in the core of networks because there was not enough forwarding entries in the routers to hold the routing table. There wasn't enough forwarding table entries in the switches to be able to switch paths through those cores. And the idea behind MPLS was that you could overload multiple IP addresses into a tag and therefore reduce the number of forwarding table entries in the core of the router. And by that definition, now this is where it starts to get a bit murky. Now, by that definition, to me, if I'm making multiple IP subnets look like one MPLS tag, that to me looks like NAT. To me, I still sit there and think that sometimes MPLS looks like NAT. I mean, it is a circuit-driven technology, and you could regard NAT as a circuit-driven technology by the same definition.
No, it doesn't look anything like that. The only thing that using the transport label to scale the core to be BGP-free core is that you are ensuring that multiple destinations, multiple IP routes are mapped to the same FAC, the forwarding equivalency class. And the definition of FAC could be anything. It could be destination routes. It could be different DSCP markings on the packets. It could be different source address. It could be the time of the day. It could be anything. So the confusion, what Greg hit on directly, calling MPLS tunneling, was why people consider it to be tunneling, because on its own, in many cases, other than a couple of examples, and one of them is the scaling of the core, MPLS on its own doesn't make much sense. It's the MPLS applications that actually make a lot of sense. MPLS applications, things like MPLS traffic engineering and the layer 3 VPNs and the layer 2 VPNs. And all of those applications, every single one of them is a tunneling. But MPLS as a transport mechanism itself is not a tunneling. It is a circuit technology. But unlike pretty much any other that we had up to now, other than, let's say, circuit emulation over ATM, it is the one that you can use the exact same technology to perform tunneling and to build very, very scalable and versatile applications with.
So what's your current definition of a tunnel? And do we decide is MPLS tunnel or not right now?
Let's say I was enlightened 5 minutes ago.
Oh.
MPLS is not tunnel. MPLS traffic engineering is not tunnel. MPLS VPN and Atom are tunnels.
Oh, because they add one label, which is for multiplexing.
Because
MPLS TE is a tunnel.
It's not.
Okay.
Because it runs in parallel with the IP routing setup labels. It's not on top, it's in parallel.
Okay, so let's get back to this tunnels as frozen interaction. Let's say your packet arrives at PEEP device and it's supposed to be routed over core. But as opposed to using routing protocol, you jack in label and route it directly using the source route. So this is why I like calling tunnels as layers of frozen interaction, because under this definition, MPLS LSP is a tunnel because it changes the forwarding paradigm at the edge, as opposed to using normal forwarding, use some sort of indirect forwarding right now. So back to Ivan's example, Atom, for example, or L3 VPN. Let's say you have two labels, one transport and a VPN label. Can you actually do Atom without the two labels? Let's say you have this LSP end-to-end, and both endpoints know, okay, this LSP is used to carry Ethernet. And so as soon as packet arrives from LSP, you send it directly to the egress circuit. And for every circuit on the egress, you create parallel tunnels from end to end. They say you have four cross connects. And as opposed to using one LSP with four MUX labels, you use four LSPs, just like in the ATM AAL MUX encapsulation. Is this sounding or not?
That's a good one. And there's another corner case that you didn't mention, which is if the PEs are directly connected. In my corner case, we actually have the null label on the transport.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, you sort of have the null label in the Atom stack.
In this case, you're gonna have explicit actual labels. Let's say you're gonna have four labels. Yes.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Right.
You could do it that way. And in that case, it wouldn't be tunneling by our definition, but it would destroy the scalability of the whole thing.
Yes, of course.
If I can inject, it would be tunneling because you would be taking one, you're forgetting that there is a layer 2 circuit beyond the PE. You are not tunneling MPLS over MPLS. You are tunneling that layer 2 circuit over the MPLS cloud that doesn't understand the original layer 2 circuit beyond the PE. And you are tunneling it across the cloud so that the other PE can understand it. So we have to here again talk about the routing protocol versus routed protocols and tunneling protocols over tunneled protocols.
Now, Marco... sort of disagree with you. If you would be transporting IP over MPLS, you would be fine and I would be fine and we would say this is not tunneling. Oh yeah, now I see. And if you're transporting Ethernet over MPLS, then this would be two layer 2 protocols. So you're saying it's tunneling because we are transporting layer 2 over layer 2, right?
Wait a second.
No, because we are transporting Ethernet over, say, entirely SONET-based IP network that doesn't understand Ethernet.
Yeah, but the protocol stack you have in the core is SONET bits, plus MPLS labels plus Ethernet. And by your definition of tunnel that I totally agree with, because we have layer 2, which is MPLS, and another layer 2, which is Ethernet, this would be, by that definition, tunneling.
Correct. Correct. And here we have to, okay, I see where you are going. Because, for example, we don't see Ethernet twice, we don't see the same protocol in the stack twice, we cannot call it the tunneling by my definition. But by my definition, this is tunneling because logically we are tunneling. Yeah. But can we then abstract the definition of tunneling a little bit further and say that if we see the same layer of the protocol stack?
That's what I said 30 minutes ago.
Okay.
What, 15.
Wait a second. But this means you actually believe that MPLS is layer 2, right?
But yes, it is.
No.
Yes, it is. No, it is not.
Oh, Marco, forget about MPLS over Ethernet. That's an abomination. Think about MPLS over point-to-point links.
Let's say RTVP or frame relay, for example.
No, well, not. Yeah, you're right. Even over PPP, we still have the PPP header. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, and let's say
layer 2.5.
Still more than MPLS, right? Where you actually don't have MPLS label, but you have it in the native label, right? In the virtual circuit label. It's like a classical problem. People always get lost when we try to define a layer for MPLS. They commonly agree it's between layer 3 and layer 2, but the whole OSI model is actually inflexible. It doesn't really actually allow us to describe properly MPLS behavior in this case.
Let's say MPLS is the upper part of layer 2, just like LLC was always considered the upper part of layer 2.
Well, LLC was mostly... Okay, that's what you're saying.
The proper LLC used by IBM in SNA, not the other LLC.
Oh, now going to proper networking, SNA.
I think that the whole OSI layer actually falls apart when you introduce the MPLS to the mix, because I have a problem calling it layer 2, and I have problem calling it layer 3, because it's neither. It is really something in between, but I have the biggest problem calling it layer 2.5, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why wouldn't you call it layer 2?
That's a good one. Because we already have a layer 2 protocol. For example, when you have point-to-point link with the PPP headers or HDLC headers or Ethernet headers, you are in the proper OSI stack. You are actually indicating to the upper layers or the lower layers what kind of information you're carrying in the upper layer. So there is an idea of a tie between lower layers and the higher layers, for example, with the ether type in layer 2 frames. MPLS doesn't carry the information about what is the upper layer header. So it really doesn't sit in the OSI stack in any way.
Yeah, it's a total layering violation. I agree with that. Because ether type actually indicates what should be sitting in the MPLS payload.
Exactly. And the ether type indicates that your layer 3 payload is MPLS.
And you have two ether types, one for IP multicast and one for IP unicast. You know that, right?
Right. And
yeah, it's a total mess.
It's a complete mess. And on top of that, the label itself doesn't carry the information about what upper layer header you have. So designers calling it a shim header, they really nailed it down. It doesn't fit in the stack. It just sits in between. It's a padding between two layers. And in that sense, you know, because it violates the whole stacking and the layering processes in the network, is it a tunnel?
And coming back, you know where it all started? With VPIs and VCIs and AL5 MUX.
Correct, but the AL5 MUX itself carried the information what the upper layer protocol was.
Oh, then the other one.
AL5 MUX, multiplexing on circuit numbers, essentially. So different VCs for different protocols.
That's true.
So,
but the fact that it was AL5 told you what the payload was.
It was just essentially the fragmentation layer. It doesn't tell you protocol. So the protocol number wasn't there.
It tells you what it isn't. That's what I'm trying to say. Because it's different than AL2, for example.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
What about things like CRC checks? So, for example, when you create an IP, when you modify the IP header, a new CRC check is run on the packet before it's transmitted off hop by hop. And the same for Ethernet. And yet MPLS doesn't. Is that a definition that you could use?
The IP doesn't do hop-by-hop check of the CRC
on the header.
Header does.
No, but Greg, that's another good one because every layer 2 should ensure that the packet is transmitted correctly between adjacent network devices. And so we have CRC or FCS in everything, Ethernet, PPP, HDLC, you name it, but not in MPLS because it's not a complete layer 2.
That's right. It's not always a complete layer 3.
It's not a complete layer 3. It's definitely not layer 3.
But it's not layer 2 either because it doesn't actually change the CRC or none of the error checks are performed.
Yes.
So getting back to my definition.
It's a clutch.
When I say tunnel as a frozen direction, I mean, it fits all the descriptions, basically. It just tells you that don't use your underlying frozen model, use some additional frozen model instead. Let's say if you take Jerry Tunnel, it's a one-hop source route. It tells you just send packet there from respective application. It goes directly from one hop to another hop. And you don't really care what's happening under the tunnel. It's just the other layer problems. That's why I kind of like this definition of a layer of frozen direction. It just creates indirection, which creates some issues, of course, but it allows to separate your view of a forwarding from the underlying forwarding on the bottom layer, on the lower layer.
Yeah, but you just defined layering, Peter.
Oh, yes. So essentially, it's not just layering. It's more like layering plus forwarding. Because
layering works the same way. You have numerous IP subnets that point to the same IP next hop, which is yet again a forwarding. What word did you say? Did you use
forwarding in direction?
Yes. So IP next hop and MAC address associated with it, it's also a forwarding indirection.
Right.
So you have to be careful because layering is exactly the same thing as tunneling when you talk about forwarding indirections.
Also, I'm struggling with one part of Piotr's definition. I've been trying to sort of run it through my mind. He also described policy-based routing with his definition, because with policy-based routing, we are not using the underlying mechanism, i.e. the regular IP routing. We can redirect the traffic anywhere we like. So policy-based routing, by that definition, is also tunneling when in reality it isn't.
Right, but it's not encoding the header. So in tunneling, you encode this directive in the packet itself, right? You put this directive in the packet as an additional shim information layer, which changes the frozen behavior in the network. With PBR, you don't add any extra information in the packet. You add X information to the network itself, classify and change the path. But
excellent. But that then means that MPLS is not tunneling because the network itself has the state what to do with the packet when it arrives with a certain destination.
Right, but
where the destination is the label.
It's still under control of the. It may be under the control of ingress node, right? Let's say when you do MPLS TE. You signal the source route using the SCP observation, right? Mm-hmm. And then you add the header, which actually starts the chain reaction, right? So you put extra information, which then actually triggers this forwarding behavior, hop by hop. Without this shim header, you won't get anything, right? So you...
Policy-based routing still fits the description. The network has the state. The fact that you had to manually configure it doesn't matter, and it's still triggered by the information in the packet header.
Right,
but just triggered by a different thing than in MPLS.
Yes, just in the tunneling, you the edge control this problem, right? The behavior. You insert the header at the edge, and then behavior actually cascades based on this information. In PBR, there is no awareness at the edge about this forwarding, right? In tunneling,
it could be. It could be. I mean, how do we define the awareness? The awareness okay. is that something is configured.
Yeah, Ivan.
Can I step back from this discussion a bit?
Yes.
Well, actually, the difference that you're discussing here is that in MPLS, the edge defines the FEC, whereas with PBR, you have to reevaluate the FEC on every node.
That's interesting.
How about the fast reroute in MPLS, where the intervening node can reroute the traffic based on a non-edge decision?
You mean
it always ends at the next hop.
What if it's
not necessarily the next hop?
Actually, yeah. Next hop is a violation because in this case you require some snooping. You need to get extra label from NN hop, right?
Correct.
So I always have extension in SVP the source route, the trace route, get the labels. So NN hop actually violates the pothole design in some respect because you snoop local information.
So nextness hop is like clutch squared.
Yes, you always see these things in protocol designs, things that look slightly unnatural, but still work perfectly.
There's two topics we talked about here, and I'll just try and recap them, and hopefully I'll get them more or less right. One is the concept of state in the network. So for any given source to any given destination, there must be a pathway defined between the two. For Ethernet, the path is stateless because when you send out the initial discovery frame, the switches broadcast the request to find the destination MAC address, and the request comes back, and then the frame is forwarded out. But the frame is sent without any knowledge of the path to the destination. IP is done similarly because when you but each router holds state about the next hop. So we have routing protocols which actually hold state in the network. And the same thing applied for those of you who've been around long enough for ATM and frame relay, where not only did the routing protocols that they used actually define the next hop, but they also defined the path from end to end and to some extent defined alternate paths, although for those of you who aren't familiar with it, not exactly the same. So that's the concept of state. The network has to have some map of itself derived by usually via autonomous. Autonomous means each router is an independent system running a routing protocol of some sort that knows about its neighbors and forms a coherent system that defines the pathways through the network. The other so that's a standard network, the way we have it today, and state is a vital part of understanding a modern network because state is everywhere. The second part about indirection means that if you actually put data, take an IP frame and put it into an IP and IP or a GRE tunnel, you have what's called indirection. You no longer know or have the original data that was contained in the header. It's lost to you unless you can do deep packet inspection. And that indirection means usually means data loss or loss of intention about what the source is. So one of the great problems with, say, for example, network address translation is that once you actually NAT a whole bunch of internal IP addresses into one external IP address, you have a loss of data around what the source is, and that's usually called indirection. And the more levels of indirection you have, the more loss you have about what the original intention of the data flow is, which is conceptually negative. Is that a fair assumption, Ivan? Is that a fair summary?
Till you got to NAT, yes.
Oh, well. Actually, I believe Greg has a good point about NAT here. If you look at MPLS LSP, yep. It changes label at every hop, right? So essentially, you change the header information at every hop. Let's say you do NAT hop by hop. Let's say maybe domain. You may effectively create some sort of logical, well, not tunnel, but LSP. Let's say logical LSP by hiding and replacing IP addresses, essentially keeping semantics local for every domain, right? So basically, the concept of MPLS label, you may reuse the labels at every hop, right? Say at every non-adjacent hop. But same for NAT, you can reuse IP addressing at every domain which isn't directly adjacent. So I guess there is some parallels which Greg was pointing here.
Okay, and you could say the same thing about Ethernet networks, only no one uses the same MAC address on different LACs.
and we are going to go back in circles, but there was something that Greg said that so opened my mind. Okay. And I think he opened a whole new window in my head. And when he mentioned, he was talking about something and something and something, and then he said, unless you're using the deep packet inspection and then something, something, something. Now, that's the whole thing. The whole layering, the whole tunneling mechanism, and the OSI layers and everything has been built 40 years ago, 30 years ago, for the networks with the capabilities of that time. In my mind, it no longer applies. It no longer works. We are trying to use ancient old technology for the modern networks using the models that no longer apply, because now the equipment can't do the line rate deep packet inspection, and we can make forwarding decisions wherever we like. I mean, isn't it time for a new network model?
Okay, you have one?
No.
I vote for the DoD model, the five-layer model. I think that was pretty good. I think they had it right. Less is more.
So sorry, Greg, they didn't. Because if they would introduce session layer, then we wouldn't have the scalability problems today, because TCP, you could terminate the same session on two IP addresses, so multi-homing would be solved. And yeah. Presentation layer, if you remember, today everything runs over HTTP, and you know why? Because it has presentation layer. Because you can say this is text and this is image.
You're talking CLNS to some extent?
Well, no. I'm saying that in a well-designed network stack, you need session layer, and I haven't seen a good one yet.
Yeah.
And you need presentation layer, and HTTP does that pretty well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, I get your point. Yeah. I think what you're saying is you want to take some bits of CLNS and some bits of IP and mash them together. You don't think so?
Well, actually, if you take a look at what people are doing with some new proposals, how to change TCP, they're actually trying to squeeze session layer into TCP.
Yeah, that's true. Things like SPDY and... Well, the SPDY protocol, for example, tries to do that, except they do it over the presentation layer.
But by the way, coming back to your NAT remark... the only difference I see between tunneling and NAT, and I agree with Peter's analysis that MPLS label switching and NAT is more or less the same. With tunneling, you can always reconstruct the original packet. Every hop in the path can reconstruct the original packet if they so wish.
So now we have a working definition for tunneling, which is... You can define a tunnel whenever you see a recursion of your layer. So if you see you have two lots of MAC or two lots of IP or two lots of TCP, then you're tunneling, and that is a one-sided tunnel. It looks like a tunnel, but it's the translation is only done in effectively the data is not de-encapsulated in exactly the same form when it gets to the other end, or rebuilt in the same form.
Well, you could say that NAT is like lossy compression and tunnel is like lossless compression.
That's perfect.
Or you can call NAT one-way encryption, like MD5 hash, and you can call the tunneling a two-way hash, where you can reconstruct the original password. But I'm still struggling, going back to the original question, is MPLS tunneling?
I'm glad you said that, because I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I'm not sure we've actually come to a conclusion about whether or not MPLS is tunneling. I think by our strict definition here that we've come up with, where we're nesting the same protocol, then MPLS is not. It is it is a forwarding mechanism that can carry any sort of a payload, but it isn't necessarily tunneling by the definition that we've come up with. It's a tag, it's a shim layer, and forwarding decisions are made upon that, but it isn't strictly like an IP and IP or Ethernet inside of Ethernet. So, but at the same time, a certain part of the conversation took us and we said, well, it could be tunneling because you can do two tags. So I don't know that we have a complete answer yet.
I think that's it. MPLS itself is not. MPLS applications are.
So absolutely agree.
But I have a question here. Why do we care if it's tunneling or not?
Thank you.
I forgot this.
But it's a nice discussion, isn't it?
it's pretty scholastic so far. It's like discussing how many angels can fit on the head of a pin, basically. I just realized, like, so why do we really care if it's tall or not?
Well, it's a philosophical question, really. And for me, the question popped in my head just because we've seen all these new different overlays that are out there. You know, VXLAN came up in this conversation. OTV is one of the Cisco flavors that's out there. And, of course, GRE's been around forever and is generally recognized as a tunnel. And then as you think about what those protocols can do, one of the recurring themes that have come up by people that have been doing networking for a long time is, yeah, but what problem does this solve for me that MPLS didn't already solve that I can't do with MPLS? Which, it as a rabbit trail in my mind, kind of a side of curiosity, well, is MPLS tunneling? And then as I thought about it, very simplistic. Think about my WAN carrier. I'm the enterprise guy. They don't hand me MPLS. They hand me Ethernet or an HDLC circuit or whatever they give me. And then I know that it disappears into their MPLS cloud and it pops out the other side. You know, I give them IP encapsulated and whatever. They end up tagging it to get it through their core. And on the other side, it comes back out as IP. Conceptually, they tunneled it. Practically speaking, according to the discussion, maybe not.
Oh,
so it became an academic point of interest for me, and obviously interesting enough to keep us all going for an hour as we chatted about it.
So I guess the real question was, what's the main difference between MPLS LSPs and IP tunnels, and what are the drawbacks and benefits of each approach to transport data, right? Let's say in data center.
That should be the initial question. Yeah.
Okay.
I think there's maybe a whole nother show to build around that. Maybe we can get Derek back in when he's free again, because that's actually the direction that he wanted to take this program. So maybe there's a part two that we can do at some point and take the conversation down that road.
So what you're saying is we just laid the philosophical foundation for that discussion.
I will also point out that when we and I know that I was sitting next to Derek and Ivan in that network field day when all of us multiple times said, but what does this solve that MPLS didn't solve? What we actually mean is the transport problem has been solved by the MPLS, and there is a possibility to build an MPLS application that could utilize the existing transport to solve this problem. And with that, you don't have to reinvent the wheel and the new protocol that we see being done today. So that's the really question we are asking when we are saying, what does this solve that MPLS didn't?
Okay, Marco, there is one thing that we keep forgetting. In MPLS VPN networks, let's say, because that's what we are always saying when we say, why wouldn't we use MPLS to solve that particular problem? We think about MPLS VPN or VPLS. In both cases, you need the LSP to every single PE router. And the PE router in our case is the hypervisor, which is okay if you have 10,000 servers in your data center. For Yahoo, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, this is not good enough. For them, MPLS would not scale because they could not build LSP to every single server in their data center.
But do you need the MPLS LSP? So the only benefit you get with MPLS LSPs is self engineering, source route, which you can carve the way you want. In the data center, the network is so uniform and so flat, not necessarily flat, but just so uniform and symmetric, you just use a CMP, basically, just spray traffic. That's yes. Traffic engineering. You don't really care. You can, of course, use, let's say, MPLS over GRE, for example, if you do MPLS VPNs, but it's basically, there's no special difference. You can just use any other VPN technique and don't use MPLS at all. MPLS was a perfect solution for partially mesh networks, like large long-haul carrier networks, to do traffic engineering or otherwise known as adaptive routing to get the full optimization, full utilization out of a network. In data center, there is no such requirement since you have plenty of bandwidth normally and you have all paths so symmetric, there is no difference whether you use MPLS for forwarding or IP for forwarding, aside from the state which you have in the network, which MPLS brings you a lot, of course, a lot of state to maintain in the core network. And especially with the class topologies, the amount of state will grow so quick, you won't find a merchant silicon switch which can do this, basically, reasonable assumption of a data center size. Because if you take the merchant silicon switches, the amount of MPLS state they can keep is like maybe a few thousand labels maximum. That's it. So from this perspective, I should say, there is no special use case for MPLS in data center unless the topology is a hypercube, which I guess we're talking before, or any other fancy topology, which is so irregular that it requires special traffic engineering capabilities to be fully utilized. If you're using class or normal tree, there is no need for MPLS traffic engineering at all. And hence, there is no need for MPLS per se.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is probably a good place for us to end the show. And I think there's room for a comparison of MPLS to some of the modern, or I should say more recent overlay techniques that we are seeing out there, some of which we've referred to in this program. And I was just talking to Derek offline here in the side channel, and I think we can get him in for that one, and we can maybe talk through VXLAN and so on, because that kind of dovetails nicely with how we were concluding the discussion here with the challenges of implementing MPLS in a very large data center environment and so on. So, I'll tell you what, I'm going to just ask each of you guys what you're going to be up to for the week, and if you've got a blog or a Twitter handle, those kind of things, so that people could follow you, why don't you let folks know what they are, and then I'll close the show out. So, Marco, let's start with you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I will be teaching next week like I do almost every week. You can find me on Twitter at IceMarcoM. I'm blogging on blogipexpert.com and on my personal blog, which is blog.marcom.info.
And thanks for coming on today, Marco. Appreciate having you on as always. And Petter.
First of all, sorry, guys, if I got discussion a little bit distracted going into the abstractions and, you know, it's classic topics. But my next week is going to be actually outside of Redmond. We're going to have a vendor visit in San Jose and visit a few networking vendors and hopefully have a lot of interesting discussions next week. As for me, you can probably find me on Twitter, although I don't tweet often, but my Twitter handle is PETRLAPU. And thanks for having me on the show. It was a pretty fun one.
It was indeed. And no apology necessary. You know, for all of the... Having a good academic conversation like that, I think, is really good. It got my brain spinning on some things that I haven't had to think about for a while. It was great. No apology at all necessary. And Ivan, I think your week can maybe be a little bit quieter than the last one. What are you going to be up to?
Webinar on Wednesday, and it's yet again about cloud networking. So I may mention some of the ideas we had today. And after that it's May 1st, and you know the eastern part of Europe has traditional May 1st holidays, so I'll be gone till Wednesday of next week. I'm at ipspace.net, and on Twitter I'm at ioshints.
Yeah, and if you don't subscribe to Ivan's blog, you need to do yourself a favor and go do that, because the kind of information you can pull out of Ivan's articles are absolutely excellent. He's right up to date on what new vendors are doing, products that are coming out, protocols that are out there, and has a lot of insightful comments, often with helpful diagrams that explain how they work and what they do. And it's an education unto itself to keep up with what Ivan's writing. So head on up there and do that. And of course, Mr. Greg Farrow, what about you this week?
Head down, bum up, focusing on the things. I've actually written a few blog posts for this week. I published a few today, there'll be some stuff wandering around. I couldn't help myself. This week will actually be, I think by the time this podcast comes out, the Brocade recordings that we did while we were in San Francisco should start to publish. We're going to publish them in some episodes. And if you remember tuning into those, there was some pretty interesting stuff from there. So they'll be out shortly.
Yeah, there absolutely was. Brocade, of course, discussing some of the new fabric concepts that are applicable to the data center, and of course they're into Trill, and that's their main mechanism that they're pushing now. So there is a lot of thought-provoking discussion in those chats we had with Brocade.
So that's my week. We'll be editing video and exporting it ready for upload to the podcast, where we'll be publishing some of that around. And then, as always, you can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter as at etherealmind. I've also had an interesting week deleting social media accounts. I recently started reading a book on social network theory about how they calculate the network graph and correlate data, and I got the willy scared out of me, quite honestly. So I'll have a blog post out shortly which talks about why I'm cancelling most of my social media and curtailing a lot of my public. You've done some reading in that, Peter?
No. Do you follow all the social graphs and page rank like algorithms?
Or you find the connections? So it was the social graph. I was reading a book about the statistical analysis program R and how they're analysing the social graph. So if you sign up for something like Instagram or Facebook, they actually analyze the data. What they're looking for is not the number of people. They're looking for the person who's the key between two different groups. So they're looking for someone. When they do the analysis, there's always one key router or one key person in the in the network graph who can affect more people than anybody else. And what Facebook's looking to, you know, what these social media companies are looking to influence is that key person in the middle. That's the... They're not targeting the mass. They're targeting just a very small number of people who influence opinion.
Yeah.
And that's scary.
We used to do similar stuff maybe 5 years ago for some monitoring system, but it was different.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about the data mining in that way, and now I'm even more frightened than I was before. I mean, I knew it's very clear. It doesn't take much searching on the internet or reading about Facebook to understand the sort of data mining they do for marketing purposes and so on. And it's really what you're agreeing to when you sign up for a lot of these sites is a direct violation of your privacy, in that anything you post out there is no longer private, and you've agreed that they can do pretty much whatever they want with that data. It's a scary and a serious business. So
well, two things. You think sometimes that Facebook is about selling you ads, but in fact, the significant part of their revenue actually comes from selling your data to somebody else. So they literally sell your contact information and your profile data to somebody else to be influenced. So and so that they can then target you outside of Facebook. And just to understand how many data points Facebook has, you know, at the bottom of every web page that you visit, there's a Facebook like button. That is actually a tracking button for every web page you go to. Because every one of those buttons has a unique ID on the CSS field that's attached to that button, and that's how they track whether you're hitting it or not. Maybe. So even if you've got cookies disabled, they can still track where you went.
Yes. Maybe we should have a podcast on world conspiracy, you know. Sounds like a great topic.
Get that one on. We'll get Mrs. Y on there for that one for sure. Anyway, well, let's wrap it up here. I am Ethan Banks. You can follow me on Twitter at EC Banks, and I blog at packetpushers.net, as do a lot of other really, really interesting authors. So thank you for listening to the show this week. You can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at Packet Pushers. Of course, like I said, visit packetpushers.net to read blogs by the growing Packet Pushers community. And we have our RSS feeds up there. We have people ask us about that. We do have a couple of RSS feeds. And if you like, donate to the show. We'd appreciate it. Email your comments or questions about this program to packetpushers@gmail.com. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.